Hello, my name is Simon Ward, and I would like to welcome you to the Triathlon Coach podcast. If you don't already know me, I'm the founder of thetriathloncoach.com and the SWAT Inner Circle, and I've been a triathlon coach for over 20 years, working with absolute beginners right up to Olympic champions and covering all distances from sprint to Ironman. Now it's my goal in this weekly 30-minute podcast to share practical, usable advice from the best athletes, coaches and experts from the world of triathlon so that you can get the most from your training time and maximise your enjoyment of the triathlon lifestyle. So as I've already said, we've got just 30 minutes, so let's get rolling with today's guest. And today's guest is Carl Alexander. Welcome to the SWATcast, Carl.
Hi, Simon.
How are you today?
Yeah, good, thank you. Just in from a couple of hours, nice easy spin, just getting some racing miles out of the legs from yesterday.
What were you doing yesterday? Time trialing, perhaps?
No, it was a criterium race in Bovingdon near Hemel Hempstead.
Okay, how did you get on?
I won.
Wow. Criterium racing's probably be a shock to the system for most triathletes because it's the completely opposite end of the spectrum from steady state effort for several hours, isn't
it? It's not just sitting at 250 watts for 2 hours. It's 1,000 watts for 2 seconds into no watts into it's quite explosive.
And you need some decent bike handling skills to cope with tight circuits and
riding in the bunch and tight circuits at speed. You need to be on top of your handling game, that's for sure.
Yeah, okay. Is that a closed circuit then that you race on?
So the Bovingdon circuit is for drift cars. They drift around it. So it's quite tight bends, lots of hairpins, some sort of more open sweeping bends. So it's actually quite a technical course, mostly left-hand turns with a few rights to get you back onto the left-hand turn. But yeah, no, it's a really nice course, nice and wide, so you can get a nice big field on there. So yeah, it's quite open as well. It's Bovingdon's an old airfield, so you get some pretty cheeky headwinds because there's nothing to stop it.
And that's another skill itself, isn't it? Riding in a bunch and hiding from the wind. And I know guys who aren't that fit, but because they've got good group racing skills, they can actually keep up with a much fitter bunch because they can hide themselves.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Back to the World Championships last year. Now, I'm not suggesting that Peter Sagan is anything other than amazing, but you didn't see him until okay to go. He was just surfing the wheels, keeping out of trouble, conserving energy until he needed to use it. And you'll find that a lot of the top guys can do that. They just got to hide themselves away until it's time to come out and put the power down and go for the line.
So, Carl, I know you was the twice winner of the Outlaw Half at Nottingham.
Yep.
But you've turned up to those races for many years now and you're well recognisable on the circuit. I know you mostly as a triathlete, but we're talking about cycling and cycle racing there. Yeah. Do you consider yourself as a cyclist or just a multi-sport athlete?
I think these days, and obviously the listeners won't know this, but obviously we alluded to this prior to recording, is I broke my arm in a crash in 2017, in the early part of 2017, that really knocked my season completely out of kilter. I was unable to race. I did one race, the Outlaw Half at Holcombe, which I abandoned after the bike. I'd been doing all my training on my road bike because I could get comfortable. And then obviously come race day, I was on my TT bike. And if you can appreciate kind of bumpy roads in a TT position on elbow pads with a broken elbow, it was like someone had taken a jackhammer to it, and it was like the most painful experience. So that was pretty much the season done. Then I had opportunity through Tri 24/7 to go to Cascais in Portugal to race the inaugural 70.3 Ironman event out there, which was fantastic. So that was the only race I really did in 2017. Over the winter, as we alluded to before, my swim training was not all it could have been because of the arm. I'd swim for maybe 5, 6, 7 minutes and the arm would start to ache, but then it would continue to hurt for 3 or 4 days afterwards. And that meant from swimming sort of daily, I was swimming once every 2 days and then once every 3 days and then once a week and then once a fortnight. And so really not doing much swimming of any kind of significance. And again, with the running, holding my arm in the bent position whilst running would cause a lot of kind of aches in the arm. And so again, I was kind of shying away from that. So whenever I had the opportunity to train, I was either jumping on Zwift or going outside on the bike, because on the road bike, it wasn't hurting, which seems sort of counterintuitive with the vibrations, but it just didn't hurt. So over the course of the winter, I think a bit of a metamorphosis happened, and I went from being kind of a triathlete to more kind of single discipline, not through choice, more kind of by virtue of circumstance. But I'm still very much a triathlete. I'm back swimming properly. I'm back running properly. I'm training properly. So, you know, I'll be back for Holcombe, hopefully.
So injury is something that all triathletes have to face at times in their triathlon career, regardless of whether they're a recreational athlete doing a few sprints a year or whether they're a top-end pro triathlete racing on the Ironman circuit and going to Hawaii. It must be quite frustrating for you to, you know, having been very competent at all three disciplines, to find that you're limited to just one of them, really, for most of the time. How do you cope with that mentally when you can't get in the pool at all, or when you've had to go? You said you were swimming virtually every day, and now you're down to once every 3 or 4 weeks because of the pain. Do you find that frustrating? And what techniques do you use to deal with that?
I think initially there is huge frustration with it. I'm looking at, I think if I could sort of just put a segue in slightly, things like Strava and other kind of social media platforms for athletes, whether, you know, you see a lot of guys posting pictures of the pool set board on, you know, on Instagram and that kind of thing. And you kind of look at that, and obviously I look at my peers and rivals, and look at what they're doing, and you feel like you're being left behind. You think, you know, oh man, I need to get in the pool. So that element of frustration kind of creeps in. But I think how I dealt with it was I was still able to ride my bike. So it's not like, in my mind, I was able to rationalize that I wasn't coming from a stand-in start. It's not like I'd broken a leg and I was able to do anything. You know, I was still able to do at least one aspect of the sport. It's not going to be, yes, I've lost a few months training, but it's not going to be an insurmountable task to get back to a reasonable standard, or close to where I was in a shorter time, given what I know works for me over however many years I've been training now. I know obviously what volume my body can handle, without going into kind of without breaking down fully. So I'm going into each session now with a kind of like almost like a renewed vigor, because that enforced layoff has kind of really motivated me to push on. And, you know, whereas maybe the last few sets I'd give up, if I'm allowed to say that. Wow. Now I'm kind of really, you know, let's do one more. And, you know, I'm coming out of the water feeling like I've really achieved something. And the same on the run, I'm finishing the set feeling really good and ready to go for the next one. So I think it's just, in terms of dealing with injury, is as long as you know it's not a long-term setback, I think you can rationalize that you will be back at a point where you can resume normal training and resume back to, you know, where you were.
Do you think that the enforced break from two of the three allowed you to refresh mentally, and that's why you're feeling so enthusiastic at the end of the swim sets and at the end of the run sets?
I absolutely do. I've been racing triathlon for coming up for 10 years. And in that time the longest period of time I've had off is probably a family holiday. And even then I've probably been guilty of sneaking off for a run or or a swim set or something, or using a pedalo as a bike session.
That's extreme.
Yeah, where needs must have. So I think having that enforced rest, absolutely, it's a blessing and a curse. But I think as long as you see it as a blessing, you can still mentally, you can still build off of that rather than kind of putting yourself in a pit of depression. And I know guys, you know, some of my training partners, when they're injured, they're unable to train. They're like caged animals. They're horrible to be around because they haven't got that outlet for that, you know, for their energy. So I think it's nice to be able to concentrate on one thing and be able to fill that void. But by the same token, it does leave you feeling refreshed and ready to go.
Yeah, I think your thoughts reflect probably most triathletes in terms of the frustration, but your approach to it is certainly very refreshing and sort of quite pragmatic, and it's probably born out of having been injured before and realizing that actually getting frustrated doesn't really help. And maybe that's down to your general personalities, that you're a bit more pragmatic and not quite as full on as some people are.
I think it's like any problem in life. It's only a problem if you make it a problem. If you can sort of identify, oh, it's like carrying a bag of bricks. Why would you put it down? You don't need that extra pressure in your life. So if you've got an injury, there's nothing you can do about it. Why dwell on it? Why worry about it? You know, if you can do other things, if you can fill the time doing other things, whether that's so a good example of this is another one of the Erdinger alcohol-free team, Pete Hollins, himself over 50 athlete, you know, really nice guy, really approachable, been suffering for a long time with an Achilles injury. Did he let that put him off? Absolutely not. He could still ride his bike. He could still swim. He knew he couldn't run, but he knew he was going to keep his fitness, a level of fitness, by swimming and by biking, so that when the Achilles eventually repaired and healed and he was good to run again, he wasn't in a dark place with it. He was able just to, okay, I'm good. Let's progressively build up the mileage and build up the distance. And so, you know, and get back into the running. I think as long as you can focus on that and you can see that as an end goal, then there's no reason to get frustrated by it. To me, I think you're just wasting energy by worrying about it. You just got to understand that it's happened and just be patient.
And I suppose that you've learned from experience as well that if you rush these things, invariably something else will break. You know, so you have to take your time. You have to take your time building back up. You've already said that you know what your body can handle, and when you're returning from an injury, if you do rush back into stuff, it can end up in just taking much longer for you to get back. So it's counterproductive.
Absolutely. And the same is true, even, you know, forget injury. Let's just look at something, you know, something as silly as a common cold or, you know, just an illness. You know, you can be, no one's going to, if you've got a cold and you carry on training at the same intensity, at the same volume, nobody's going to pat you on the back and say, wow, you're a hero. But when you're then out of action for another 3 weeks because you've lowered your immunity and you'd absolutely, you know, feel like death warmed up, people are going to say, why did you continue training? Are you an idiot? It's you're not going to win any hero points by, you've got to learn as athletes, people need to learn to listen to their bodies and understand what their body's telling them. The bodies are very effective of saying, no, mate, quit, stop that. Because now that's not to say that when the going gets tough, when you're in, you know, upper threshold zone 5 heart rate sessions on an interval session, that you go, oh, my body's telling me to stop, and you quit. That's obviously not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is you need to understand to learn the signal, read the signals that your body's sending you, and interpret those correctly and in the correct way, so that the training you're doing is meaningful and it gets you to the point you want to be at, rather than just this constant level of decline into fatigue because you think that this high volume approach, or, you know, or because it's on your training plan, you absolutely have to do it.
We've been talking a lot recently about heart rate variability, but there's a measure that you allude to there, which Kelly Starrett, the guy who wrote Supple Leopard and is well known for his expertise on recovery methods and the like, talks about desire to train. And I think we've all experienced that, getting up in the morning and sort of feeling a bit tired and a bit fatigued and thinking, well, should I go training? Should I not? You know, an hour later, you're still on a cup of tea and you're thinking, well, should I go training? Should I not? That's probably a good sign that you probably shouldn't. But equally, we have those moments where we, you know, is it laziness? It's identifying whether it's laziness or whether it's fatigue, isn't it? And it does come down to knowing your body. And generally, that desire to train is a really good indicator if you can listen to it and not let the fact that it says you have a hard day on your plan override the sensible decision, which is, well, I could always put that hard ride off tomorrow and take an easy day today. And actually, you and I probably know, and you might be an example yourself, that longevity in the sport is born out of making the correct decisions in looking after your health than it is in just beasting yourself continuously.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's funny enough, when I was driving home from an event just earlier this week, I was talking to my dad, and we were talking about, so he's got some health issues. And we were just sort of saying about, you know, if you don't look after your body, where are you going to live? It's the only thing that's yours. It's truly yours. Everything else in life is material. It doesn't matter. It doesn't, but your body is the only thing. So as an athlete, we all put our bodies through incredible amounts of stress. I mean, that's obviously how the human body works. You stress it, it rebuilds, it gets stronger. But if all you're doing is putting your body under stress, it's like jumping in your car on a cold morning, revving the bollocks out of it at 9,000 RPM every day. It will break. Something will give. And the same is true of the body. If you're going full gas, you know, through in cold weather, in warm weather, if you're ill, if you're not, at some point your body's going to turn around and go, fella, seriously, calm down, and something will break, something will give. So it's so important, as you say, for the longevity in the sport to understand your body, to listen to your body, and don't be afraid. Don't be, if it says, as you say, Simon, you know, long hard bike on this day, you know what, I'm not really feeling that today. I will do that tomorrow, but today I'm going to do this session because I, you know, I'm feeling a bit of residual fatigue from my intervals yesterday or whatever it might, you know, whatever it might be. So it's just having that confidence. And if you do work with a coach, have those conversations, have that chat, you know, see what the coach says. And, you know, and if that backs up your feeling, then obviously you've got it right.
There's a lot of talk now about what limits human performance is the brain, not the body, and not
the central governor theory.
Well, that's what I'm coming around to, but you know, I've discussed with a few friends before about the central governor theory. So you can take it in an acute sense that you're running in an Ironman, and you've reached 12 hours, and in your brain it's going, do you know, I don't think this is good for us to carry on now. I'm just going to make you feel a little queasy, so you can't take on any energy, so you're going to run out of gas, and you're going to have to stop. But of course, because we want to finish, we ignore that, and then you sort of start feeling a bit sick, and perhaps you dry retch, or maybe you throw up, or you start feeling a bit dizzy because it keeps giving you these messages. I think it might be better if you stopped. And we ignore it, and sometimes you end up like Ali or Johnny Brownlee, where you black out near the finish line because your body just says, right, that's it, lights out.
Yeah.
In a more chronic sense, you referred to people getting ill, but we carry on, we get a sore throat, we think, well, you know, I've got this to do, and it's tough being an Iron Man, and so, you know, and I've got to battle through this, so you carry on, and then a week later, you develop a cough, because you've not listened, and then your body, you don't listen to the signals about the cough, and you carry on, and then you start to get a chest infection, and your body is sending you stronger and stronger signals that it might be best to take a bit of time off. And then one morning you wake up and actually you just can't get out of bed because you're dizzy, or you're coughing so much that your eyes are watering and you've got a throbbing headache, and it's sort of, it's giving you an even stronger reminder. And then if you still don't listen, maybe you end up in hospital.
Yeah.
Or the people that I've known that have pushed themselves so hard that they're running along a path with no obstacles, but they manage to somehow trip over the only stone in the path and twist their ankle, and so they can't train for 2 or 3 weeks. And you think, well, they'll say, well, that's such bad luck, tripping over that stone. But actually, the stone was there, you were focused on it, you weren't thinking properly, you didn't pick your feet up because you were tired, and your central nervous system had sort of wasn't responding. And again, it's a greater force has taken control to taken action because you wouldn't listen.
Absolutely.
You know, some of the scientists out there will say that that's poppycock, and but I've seen it happen so many times that it's got to be more to it than just some sort of idle theory over a glass of wine.
I think you're probably onto something. I don't know if it's your body is quite as cognitive as you've made out that your body and your mind are somehow, your conscience are somehow separate. But I think, you know, your body, it's almost instinctive. Again, just a little segue. If a dog eats something that it doesn't agree with, it'll eat grass to try and make itself vomit. It doesn't know to eat grass. It just does it. It's instinct. But the body is sending the signals to that dog, eat this because that'll make me retch, and that'll get that's bugging you out. So a dog doesn't know that. It's not sentient in a way that it can, you know, it's not thinking. It's just is. It's just, you know, I'm a dog owner, so I know mine too are stupid as hell. But it's the same with the body. Your body is saying, you know, you people, athletes, or just, you know, general public, or people with a passing interest in triathlon that might listen to this, they might be sitting at home one day and go, oh man, I really fancy a bag of salt and vinegar crisps. You know, real craving. Why is that? Well, probably because you've got low sodium levels and your body's going, yeah, fella, get me some salt. You know, it's giving you that, it's giving you that kind of desire to want to go and have that bag of crisps, or I fancy a bag of sweets, because you've got low glycogen levels, you've got low sugar levels. So I think there's probably something to that, in the sense that your body's saying stop, and it's sending these signals or shutting down certain parts of the body, certain parts of the brain, you know, peripheral vision. Or I mean, I've certainly had it when I've been training, especially when I've been on the limiting sort of time trials, where I've started to kind of get tunnel vision.
Yes, everything just closes in a little bit, doesn't it?
And it's a horrible sensation. It's but it happens, and it's about understanding those. You know, maybe I should back off a bit. And it's, as I said earlier, it's about learning to understand those signals that your body's sending you. You know, if your body is craving a bar of dairy milk and it's not something you normally have, you've got to ask yourself why. You know, so there's clearly something not quite right, or something in your diet, or your body just needs it or wants it. So, you know, give into it. I mean, don't go and eat an entire gatto, because that's pointless.
No, hold on. It's not pointless, Carl. It's probably not the right thing to do, but it's never pointless to eat a gatto. I think you'll find that there's probably quite a few people who'll be listening to this that agree with me on that one as well.
Yeah, well, I think my wife would probably agree with that one, actually.
Okay, right. Well, look, you've clearly got an understanding of your body. You've had some great results. You've got some good sponsorship as well. Actually, you're not a full-time athlete now. I know you raced as a pro, but my understanding is that you've never been a full-time athlete. So what is it you do for an income, Carl?
Well, so many of you will have seen me at events, but also know that quite often, more than not, I'm wearing an Erdinger t-shirt behind the Erdinger stall, pouring samples of Erdinger to supply with the participants that finish the events. So I actually am the UK operations manager for the company that runs Erdinger in the UK. So I work with Peter Gowans, who is in charge of Erdinger as a brand in the UK. And that's my job. I run all the events and operations in the UK.
And how long have you been with Erdinger?
So as a sponsored athlete, this is my fourth or fifth year.
And working for them?
2 years now. Prior to that, I was an IT service desk manager.
Okay. Right. So did the job with Erdinger come out of your sponsorship you had with them as a brand ambassador?
Yes and no. My job with Erdinger came out of Pete taking advantage of my good nature and me helping him out one weekend, and then it suddenly just turned into a job. So it was kind of a natural progression from the product, from Erdinger being so successful that we were asked to be at a lot more events. So the event portfolio grew, and obviously there's only one Pete. So he needed someone that he could rely and trust on to run other events. And it just kind of snowballed from there.
But knowing your personality, being at events, interacting with people, chatting with them, you know, serving them with beer, that's probably right up your street, isn't it? It's less like a job and more like a vocation.
Well, I mean, I'm talking about triathlon and beer. I mean, is there such thing as a dream job? If there is for me, it's, you know, what's not to like? It's fantastic. And yeah, you're talking to like-minded people. You know, you're talking to people that that love the sport, they're passionate about the sport, and it's nice to sort of have that relationship over. You know, they finished an event that I've more often than not done as well, and then I start serving them. You know, we can then kind of have that bond and a chat over the, you know, well, it's quite windy out there today, or, you know, or how was your event, you know, and have those nice sort of conversations with people, which is really great. And that's the part of the job I love the most, is it's absolutely fantastic.
Well, you've been an interesting time perhaps to switch the conversation then to this idea of being a brand ambassador, because I had Amy Kilpin on the show last week, and then the week before that we talked to Kit Walker. Now all three of you are sponsored by Raceskin.
Yep.
As brand ambassadors, and I know Colin from Raceskin quite well. But you are what I would say is the epitome of a brand ambassador. You're on the, as you mentioned, you're on the Erdinger stand. If we talk about the events where most people would probably have come across you, you're at the Outlaw events. People will often see you registering, but then 10 minutes later they'll be going into race briefing and you'll be standing at the Erdinger stand providing them with a pint to take in for the so they can stay hydrated while they listen to the briefing. And then you'll be at the finish line after you finish the race, sometimes having won it, tipping Erdinger over yourself and then helping them to get one as well. So, you know, people, and you wear your Erdinger t-shirt when you're moving around the site. So people link you with the brand and the brand with you. So, and that's what I would want if I was a sponsor from a brand ambassador, somebody who's interacting with the customers and just, you know, not outwardly selling the brand, but just being associated with it. Now, there is a bit of a debate going on one of my Facebook pages at the moment about what's a brand ambassador, what's sponsorship. And again, we talked to Kit about this because Kit would say he's making his way as a pro athlete, but he gets good support. But he also looks after his brands very well. Whereas Amy would call herself an average age grouper. She's finishing just off the podium in some 70.3 and a half Ironman races. But she does represent the brands very well, and she's very professional about the way she goes about all of that. So how do you represent, apart from Erdinger, how do you represent some of those other brands who sponsor you?
Okay, so let's just rewind slightly and look at why does a company sponsor an athlete or you know, actually using triathlon as the model, why would a company say to either Kit or myself or Amy, say, right, we would like you to ride our bikes or to wear our kit, or it's exposure for them. First and foremost, it's about getting their product out there, being visible and showing other people that, you know, that this is great kit. That's why they're doing it. That's why they're making the investment in you as a person. It is quite simply advertising. From a ambassadorial point of view, you need to understand that when you're wearing that kit, you not only is it you that's on display, but it's also those people that have put their money into you. So it's about being, as you've already alluded to, it's about being friendly. It's about being approachable. It's not always about winning. The results sometimes are secondary to being a presence and being available to talk. And
would you say that influence, you know, influencing, you know, you're quite well respected within the sport of triathlon, and I guess that people look up to you and therefore you would be an influence on them in terms of their buying decisions.
We spoke about some of my sponsors. One of my sponsors being Planet X Bikes. Planet X is a well-known company. It has its base in the north, Rotherham, one of its shops in Sheffield and those sort of places, which makes it a lot harder for Southern athletes to go up there and have a look at the bikes. You know, it's a 3-4 hour round trip. So I quite often, either on Twitter or on Facebook, get direct message saying, "Hi, Carl, I know that you race the XO3 time trial bike. I've been looking at various different bikes. It'd be interesting to hear your take on what you think about that particular bike." And so as a brand ambassador for Planet X, as being one of their team riders, of course, I'm going to respond, and I like to think that I give. I don't always allow my relationship with Planet X to. If I'm riding something that's crap, I'll say it's crap, because I don't want people to part with their money based on something I've said, and then they go, "What are you talking about?" But they're not. The XO3 is one of the fastest time trial bikes I've ever ridden. I absolutely love it. I think it's fantastic, and as a result, I say that to people.
I'll interject there as well. I don't know if you remember that a couple of years ago when you got one of the prototypes, I asked you about that particular bike.
Yeah.
And you did give me a good feedback. Now, I've known Dave Loughran for years, even before. Yeah. I mean, I knew Dave Loughran when he was employing Dave Brailsford to work for him, not the other way around.
That was money, Dave Brailsford.
Way back before, you know, back in the 90s, I used to buy power bars from Dave. So I've known Dave an awful long time, and I've seen the growth and, you know, the changes at Planet X. But you spoke to me about that XO3, and on the back of that, I went to Dave and asked him if he could sort me out a bike, and I got an XO3, which I took to Hawaii with me last year, and it was a lovely bike. I have nothing but praise for it. I'm not riding one now because I've got brand ambassador representation with somebody else. But I love that bike, and they do nice paint jobs. And I,
if you can't miss my bike in transition.
No, you can't. And if you can put up, if you know Dave and you can put up with him, then he's a great person. And they'd what you call it, they'd be what you call a disruptor, wouldn't they, in the cycle world?
But that's another
subject. But in terms of being a brand ambassador, I contacted you. I'd met you already a few times at the Outlaw, so it was easy to chat with you. But you gave me a very good bit of feedback about the bike, and on the back of that, I went out and got one. So I guess that is what Dave wants.
Exactly. From his relationship with me as an athlete, as an ambassador for his brand, I don't know how many people have bought bikes off the back of my recommendation. But the fact that here I am, and as you say, Simon, you know Dave very well. I've been with Planet X for 5 years. Now, there's, with the exception of Hal Davis, there's not many people that can say that they've been sponsored by Planet X for that long, because Dave can be quite, you know, if you're not cutting the mustard, you're gone. So it's about, as I said earlier, it's about giving the brand the return on the investment they're making in you, whether that's supplying you with kit, whether it's, in this instance, bikes, or, you know, if it's trainers, if it's apparel, if it's wetsuits, goggles, if it's using kit, big bobble hats. Regardless of what it is, it's about putting that out there and getting that message across. Now, and again, we spoke about this prior to recording. You have to be a very personable personality. You have to be approachable. You have to be friendly. If you're a gruff, miserable sod, people aren't going to want to talk to you. And then people are going to have a negative association with that brand because you're wearing that brand. You know, if you're sat there wearing just off the top of my head, Blue 70 t-shirt, obviously I know Tom quite well.
Can you actually see what I'm wearing right now? Because I've got a Blue 70 t-shirt on right now.
Yeah, and you're gruff and miserable. How did I know? But, you know, it's one of those, again, it's so people are going to be, by association, they're going to be put off that brand. They're going to think, well, I'm buying Blue 70 because that guy was, you know, he was an arse. So they're going to buy a Hoob or a Zone 3 or, you know, whatever else, Sailfish, you know, whatever it might be, they'll look elsewhere. So it's really important. And obviously parts of that is kind of social media presence. I mean, I don't constantly put things out on social media. I think you can saturate it. And I think that really does.
I agree with that. I think it's got to be, and this is something that Amy touched on, is if you're just constantly putting out an advert for, hey, I've got this Blue 70 wetsuit, you'd want a discount code here. You can do that with the group that know you, but on the wider scale, you've got to be a little bit more subtle about your messages.
I think it has to be organic. For example, this week I've raced two criteriums. I've won both. I've put pictures out on me on social media of crossing the finish line, miles in the air, and on Instagram, on Twitter, Facebook, and I've tagged Colin in it, I've tagged the racing kit in it, I've tagged Planet X Bikes in it, because at that point it's an organic thing. I've achieved something, I'm proud of that, so I'm putting it out there to the wider audience to say, hey, look at me, I'm mega, and this is what I was wearing while I was being mega. So I think but what I'm certainly not going to do is in a week's time is revisit that. I'm not going to recycle that information. There's no point. It's gone. That's past.
Yeah.
So if all you're doing constantly is just, as you say, oh, check out my new kicks, they're brilliant. Oh, I set a new PB today in my whatever, you know, Skechers, whatever. And that was just the first trainer brand. The other trainer brands are available. It's one of those, you know, people just go, oh man, this guy.
He's relentless. He's always trying to push all this stuff. And then I think that's the problem. And again, something else that I've touched on with both Kit and Amy is about this loyalty. If you're one of these people that pimps himself around and you're wearing an Orca wetsuit this year, and last year you were wearing a Hoob, and the year before you were wearing this, you know, how can you say this product is the best in the world when last year you were saying, oh, this one's the best one in the world? Yeah. People see through that.
Yeah, and it dilutes that message. Well, I've been with Planet X, Erdinger, Hoob, Race Skin now for, 3 years? True Start Coffee, 32 GI Sports Nutrition. I've been with those companies now for, I think 32 GI is the newest one, for 2 years. So there's that long-term, I'm long-term committed to the sponsors.
Yes.
And in return, the sponsors are long-term committed to me. I do what they ask. Well, to be honest, I, more often than not, I go above what they ask. But it's about having that open and honest dialogue with those sponsors. And as you say, if you're constantly jumping around, you have to ask yourself, well, why were you Blue 70 2 years ago? Now you're Zone 3. Now you're Hoob. Why, you know, why all these changes? That to me suggests actually you're probably quite a good athlete because you're getting the results and you're getting on podiums and you're getting good exposure. But why are these companies not keeping hold of you? So that to me sends a kind of, opens more questions about the person as opposed to the brand. And then again, you think to yourself, you know, the brand, is that a bad brand? Because it's potentially a bad fit. So it's kind of swings and roundabouts, really. I think you've got to have that loyalty to what it is you're doing and who you're working with.
Yeah, I think also that, as you said, there's the obvious, you know, you've got, you mentioned True Start Coffee, so they send you a bag of new Lava Java coffee that they've bought out, and there's an Instagram photograph of you with you. Hey, guess what? True Start Coffee just sent me in there. But you know, you can, it can be subtly different, couldn't it? You could be just sitting there reading the newspaper, with a cup of coffee, and there doesn't even need to be any inference. You just say, hey, just chilling out after a hard ride, and people will get that. Or, I mean, for me as a coach, I often, you know, you've probably seen them, and I think most listeners will have done. I do my little videos. I might not be talking anything about wetsuits, but I will wear a Blue 70 t-shirt. Mm-hmm. And it's just there as a subliminal message in the background.
Yeah.
Or, you know, so. All right, well, I just wanted to move on to a couple of other things, Carl, because we've not, not got long left. I was drawn to when I was doing a bit of background research, I was drawn to a blog post that you wrote several mm-hmm. years ago. You were actually talking about a decision to withdraw from Kona, but the basis of that decision was some health issues that your daughter had.
Yes.
And I know we talked about how your Erdinger relationship kicked off as a result of this, but that to me indicated that even at the level you race at, and clearly if you've qualified for Kona, then you're an elite age grouper, life has its challenges, and sometimes those challenges need to take priority. And that's something I find, if I was a sponsor, that's something I would find very attractive in a person, is that they have their life sorted properly and they were a good role model.
Yeah.
Because I do know that a lot of people get their life out of kilter a little bit with when we're sort of so focused on training for triathlon. So are you able to go into a bit more detail about that situation and you know,
the other
challenges that you face with, you know, working and training and trying to get these good results?
It's as you say, there's a blog post about it. So there's absolutely no secret. It's out there in the, you know, on the internet for anyone to go and read. So essentially, when my youngest daughter was born, after every newborn baby after 5 days had the 5-day heel prick test, where they're tested for a multitude of potential life altering illnesses. One of those they test for is something called MCAD, which is medium chain acyl CoA dehydrogenase deficiency, which is essentially, it's the enzyme that breaks down medium chain fats is lacking or isn't present in the body. So when she's burning fat for fuel, the enzyme will break down the medium chain fats, but only to a certain point. And then what's left is a very toxic substance, and it builds and builds and builds in the body and can lead to fatality. And some studies have suggested that it was potentially a major contributing factor to sudden infant death syndrome until it was identified. I think it was a German study that kind of identified it. So she was diagnosed with that, which, as you can appreciate, is quite a significant bombshell to have dropped on you. So she was born in August, obviously September, historically always October. So I was to and from from Great Ormond Street Hospital with my daughter. Obviously my other daughter, my eldest daughter, had to be tested as well. So it was a big period of upheaval and uncertainty from my eldest daughter's perspective as well, whether or not she had the condition. So yeah, I made that. It wasn't a decision. Let's be frank about that. There was absolutely no decision-making process. It was, I'm not going to Kona. Kona's not going anywhere. I think I said in the blog post that, you know, I'll try and requalify at a later date. For the record, I've never tried to requalify, and I don't think I ever will. But that, as you say, I mean, from a sponsor point of view, when when Erdinger were looking at potential athletes and they read that about me, they like you say, they read that and they said, well, this is, you know, this is just a normal guy. He's a dad. He's a husband. You know, he loves his triathlon, but it's a part of his life. It's not his life. And that was quite a nice thing to be recognized for and to be given that opportunity to represent Erdinger on a wider scale, on a bigger platform, going around the UK, getting entrance to the Outlaw and other big UK events and racing wearing their logo. So that was really nice, a really nice opportunity for me. And then from that, other sponsors became interested, Planet X. And so, and it kind of, the ball started to roll. And as I kind of got more sponsors, I felt more of an obligation to kind of maybe get some results. And then I started winning races and yeah. And it kind of all went from there. So it was a very organic process that I went through.
And what sort of challenges in your everyday life does your daughter's illness give you now then on a day-to-day basis?
Well, it was a lot harder when she was a baby, a toddler. Elsie, my youngest daughter, she's now six. She's very articulate, very clever little girl. So she understands the condition, completely understands. There's a charity that called Climb is for metabolic conditions with children, or with anyone. And we joined that, and they sent through like this. It's a little book, a little brochure, and it's specifically aimed at children, but they can take it to school to show their friends, show their teachers, and it's got kind of little bite-sized nuggets of information in there so that she can understand it. So she knows that when she starts to feel a bit like a diabetic, you know, they know when they need some sugar. When she starts to like slump, she knows that she needs some glycogen. She knows she needs some sugar because her body's starting to try and burn fat. So she'll have a quite a sugary snack. So whether that's a carton of Ribena or a chocolate button or something, whatever it might be, just to give her that glycogen, that little sugar kick to get her back out of that. So it's a lot easier now, because obviously it's very difficult to articulate to a baby.
Yes.
If they don't eat, they could die. They just don't really comprehend what you're saying because they're a baby. And the same true with a toddler. They don't fully understand the severity of it. That's not to say that she lives in fear of the condition. It's something that she knows she's got and she deals with it like any child would.
So you've pretty much educated her on how to look after herself. And does she have to take medication on a daily basis?
No, so it's purely medicated through diet. So, I mean, it kind of helps that both my wife and myself eat very healthily anyway. We don't, we don't binge on crap. So it's nice that, so she was never going to be in a situation where she was going to be eating a high fat diet anyway. The potential is because she can't burn fat. People say, oh, she must be quite a big girl. Well, no, she's not. She's a slim 6-year-old kid, because she doesn't eat, her tea isn't a Ginsters pasty. It's it's a well-balanced meal. I'm not suggesting that if anyone from Ginsters is listening that yours.
There goes your sponsorship for Ginsters that was just coming
up,
Kyle. I remember Bob Brown, actually. Do you remember Bob Brown?
No.
He was an ultra distance triathlete. I think he was one of the first British guys, along with Eric Seedhouse, to do the Decaman. But Bob was sponsored by Ginsters, but unfortunately he was gluten intolerant, so that made it quite difficult for him. But he was based in Cornwall, and they were a Cornish company.
yeah.
just a funny aside. But anyway, so your daughter's okay. You had those challenges. You prioritised family and health, which is something I'm constantly battering on about. You seem to have a nice balance in your life between racing, between mixing with the people that take part in triathlon and giving you that exposure there. You've articulated very well, I think, this whole brand ambassador thing, and it contribute nicely to a debate that's currently on Triathlon Coach Cafe page. And I think, whilst you do get results, I think it's quite right that you say it's not all about results. You can have an athlete that gets great results that's an arse, and therefore that people don't want to be associated with them. And you can have people that also don't get particularly, you know, as some people might consider, they're not particularly outstanding results, but they're an amazing personality. They influence a lot of people in their community. And if they're associated with a brand, people might switch on to that and actually get interested in it. And that's ultimately in this modern day and age is what sponsors want. So, Carl, I'm sure that after listening to this, you're going to have an awful lot more followers. So where can our listeners find you in the social media sphere?
In the realm? So at Carl R. Alexander on Twitter and Carl.Alexander1 on Instagram.
So at Carl R. Is it Carl, yes, with a K?
Yes.
At Carl R. Alexander, right. That's Twitter. Yep. What was Instagram?
Carl.Alexander1.
Facebook?
Is for people that know me.
Okay. Website?
I call it try247.com.
You do a bit of work for them as well, don't you? Going out,
yes,
and
again,
and race reports.
Yes, absolutely. So that's I've been providing this site when you know John Leveson incredibly well through your work.
I do, yeah.
Commentary. So I've been writing reports and reviews and things for them for a number of years. I did have a website, but I was posting everything on Try247, so the website just kind of seems to like bit like points.
Great. Well, that's fantastic, Carl. Thank you so much for your time today. Listeners, I hope you've enjoyed listening to Carl. I think it's been a nice summary of the previous two guests that we've had on, Kit Walker and Amy Kilpin. So, Carl, best wishes for the remainder of your season. See you at the Outlaw.
Thanks so much. See you in a few weeks.
Listeners, thank you for listening yet again. I do appreciate every time when you tune in and choose our podcast to listen to over some of the others that are out there, or maybe just in front of some of the others that are out there. We'll be back in future weeks with more great guests. But for now, from me and Carl Alexander, thank you very much for being guests on the Swapcast. Bye for now. That wraps up this week's episode. I'd just like to say thank you for taking the time to listen to the conversation today, and I hope you learned at least one thing that you can put into practice in your training. Now, if this was your first time listening, please go back and listen to our previous episodes. I can guarantee that they will be just as good as you heard from today's guest. If you've listened to all the episodes so far, then thank you so much for continuing this learning journey with me. As you might be aware, reviews and ratings are the currency of podcasts, so I would really appreciate it if you could leave a review and a rating on iTunes or Podbean. You could also follow me at the same time. I also have a free gift for you. In 30 years of competing in triathlon and 20 years of coaching, I've learned an awful lot from my own experiences and from some of the guests who have and will appear on this show. And I feel it's my duty, as I approach the latter stage of my coaching career, to share these with you. So I've put together 25 of my best training, racing and lifestyle strategies, and I've squeezed them down into just 2 pages of content. And in order to get hold of this, all you need to do is email triathlonsuccess to beth@thetriathloncoach.com and she will send it right back out to you. You could also think about joining my Facebook community. It's called the Triathlon Coach Cafe. We've got over 2,300 members just like you, eager to find out more about how to improve their training and share their successes with people. It's free to join, but you will have to ask. So go along there, answer the questions, and then we'll even do a little video each week to answer your questions. Finally, if you want to make sure you don't miss future episodes, please subscribe using Podbean or iTunes. We release new episodes every Wednesday. So that's all for now. See you again next week, same time, same place.